It is built in to the DNA of Zionism. It's the DNA of any settler colonialism. But yes, everyone knows, everyone can see that if Israel succeeds in ethnically cleansing Gaza, then the West Bank and inside 48-67 Israel will follow. And Israel also has an appetite perhaps to change the regime in Jordan, war with Lebanon, and of course the shameless attack on a diplomatic
indeed, and Mick, I know the Iranian question will resume, and I'll touch base on that with you after we discuss the two main protagonists here, because U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussed the Israeli bombardments of Gaza during the meeting he had with the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron on Tuesday. Now, the two ministers talked about efforts to reach a sustainable ceasefire and get more aid into Gaza. This meeting comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu escalated his pledge to invade Rafah. Let's listen in.
We, of course, discussed the situation in the Middle East and in Gaza. Israel has made important commitments to significantly increase the supply of humanitarian assistance throughout Gaza and has taken some initial actions as well to move on those commitments. We're looking at a number of critical things that need to happen in the coming days, including opening a new northern point of entry for assistance into Gaza, using Ashdod on a regular basis, maximizing the flow of assistance from Jordan, as well as putting in place a much more effective deconfliction mechanism with the humanitarian groups that are providing assistance.
Antony Blinken there, the U.S. Secretary of State. Charles, during that same press conference, David Cameron mentioned that he will, as far as he's concerned, continue the arms sales to Israel, despite the fact that hundreds of British legal experts have written to the Prime Minister to say, you are breaking international law here and you are in danger of facilitating a genocide.
That's true. They don't seem to care about these international cases.
Pesky international.
Yes, get off me. Because they're not, they've got no teeth, and so they're not worried about these cases going on. And it just seems like, again, it's this move towards war, whether it's coming from America, Britain, or some force above them, they just seem to be pushing us towards that. And of course, countries have a vested interest in selling weapons. It's a big part of their economy. But I don't know why they're not backing off. And Labour do not seem to be on the same vein. They're not talking about stopping arms, sale of arms to Israel either. And I know we're going to talk about the Germany case as well. But it just baffles me that these people... I mean, I was sitting here... the last time I was sitting there, Biden was talking about a ceasefire within days. The following week, he said there'll be a ceasefire. But I mean, all the time they're talking and chatting, and you know, people are dying every day. And I just wonder how they would feel if it was their family that were dying out there. Maybe they would feel differently. But at the moment, they seem happy to just talk and discuss this and discuss that, while every day people are dying. And Netanyahu is just... I don't know if the guy is a psychopath or what, but he's a very dangerous person, hanging on to his political career, of course.
By the skin of his teeth, yes. Some might say, Mick Napier. And the idea here that we've had regional fears about an escalation, and then we saw that provocation with the Israeli attack on the Iranian consular building in outside Damascus, Syria. Just give me your feel on that, and what is actually in this? If you were perhaps Tel Aviv, what's the motivation here?
I think the motivation is, one, ethnically cleanse all of Palestine, or pretty much all Palestinians. But there's also an existential fear, as well as a great violence at the heart of the Zionist project. I mean, 7 million or 6 million Zionist Jews are surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs and other Middle Eastern people who can switch on their television and see people being slaughtered because they're not Jewish. And that's burning very deeply into the psyche. In a very real sense, the Zionists, the degree of violence, the genocidal nature of it, the fact that they want to be seen, the fact that there's no great problem when Israeli soldiers film themselves committing obscene acts of torture and brutality and jeering and sneering at murder, that they've emptied the intensive care unit by everyone dying and all the neonatal units as well. All that, I think, stems from the fact that Israel knows that ultimately they don't have a great future in the region, that 7 million cannot prevail against 200-300 million indefinitely. But in order to extend the life of the Zionist project, they need to instill terror. They need to send a message that they're kind of crazy, that they are ready to drop, as they have done, more tonnage on Gaza than were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki together. They are capable of any barbarism, and I think that stems from the DNA of the Zionist project to build an exclusively Jewish state in the middle of the Middle East as an extension of Western power into that region. So I think, given that they failed to defeat the Hamas and Islamic Jihad in a very short time, what do? They have to raise the ante. And I think the desire for a regional war is not shared by Blinken and Biden at the moment, but I think it would get Netanyahu and the Zionist elite out of the pickle that they've got themselves into, because they haven't won in Gaza in the simple sense that for a military army like Israel's to win, they have to crush and defeat the enemy. For irregular forces like the Palestinian resistance to win, they merely have to survive. That's the lesson of all anti-colonial struggles. And I think we're seeing Israel failing to win, as they failed in 2006. And I think why Biden and Blinken are angry is Israel has failed. And that's the only crime that Washington actually acknowledges, when they failed to terrorize the region effectively. But it's very dangerous, because they will now up the ante,
with more lives obviously hanging in the balance there. Well, the holy month of Ramadan was supposed to bring a ceasefire in Gaza, but Israel actually escalated the offensive and has also gone on a killing rampage on Eid, normally a joyous time to celebrate the end of the holy month. Now, we asked the pro-Palestinian activist in London, Zebunisa Rao, why she thinks that ceasefire didn't hold.
Israel does not want to. It has the ironclad support of the loudest governments in the West. It has laid out plans and will not stop until its aims are complete, unless it is stopped. The UNSC resolution for Ramadan was passed on 25th of March, 15 days into Ramadan. The US abstained, while John Kirby, the White House National Security spokesperson, told reporters, "Our vote does not, and I repeat that, does not represent a shift in our policy." Biden signed off on $4 billion more in weapons for Israel to further the genocide. On the following day, March the 26th, the US passed a bill where it mentioned that it will limit funding to the West Bank and Gaza if the Palestinian Authority obtains UN statehood, or if it allows or supports any war crime investigation against Israel at the ICC. Israel has a blatant disregard for authority of any kind, even for the hand that feeds it. According to Article 25 UN Charter, ratified by the US, all UNSC resolutions are binding and not optional. In December 2016, UNSC passed a resolution deeming Israel's settlements in Palestine to be illegal and a violation of international law. Israel ignored this resolution. In December 2023, the UN General Assembly voted with an overwhelming majority to call for a humanitarian ceasefire. Israel refused to act on it. Israel Knesset member Balmog Cohen said, "During Ramadan, now is the best time to kill them." Israeli Heritage Minister Amichai Eliyahu said the so-called month of Ramadan must be wiped out, and our fear of this month must also be wiped out. Leaflets were dropped into the West Bank wishing a happy Ramadan and warning against even thinking against Israel or taking part in protests. Israel has stated repeatedly that it would not comply with any orders and that it will escalate in Ramadan, and this is unsurprising.
Zebunisa also said the UN can bring the genocide in Gaza to an end if it wanted to.
Israel has historically defied orders of the highest authority time and time again. What else do we expect it to do in the future? The next step after Israel defies a binding resolution would be to suspend it from the UN, and when it continues defying it, for it to be expelled. I'm sure they won't bat an eyelid. The US and the UK are ready to wage war at the drop of a hat anywhere in the world. The UK nation was asked to bravely tighten our belts as we weaponized Ukraine against Russia, and now Israel. So why have these governments not helped arm the people of Gaza? Why are world leaders afraid to unite in a simple military defensive stance for a nation of people who are unarmed, unprotected, and experiencing a slow and gradual physical decimation in the face of total annihilation? Although the UN appears sloth-like, yet similar to a sloth, it does have teeth and claws. In 1948, the UN Security Council authorized the deployment of UN military observers to monitor the armistice agreement between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Many options can be availed for military presence, but the fastest option is immediate Air Force contingents. According to the UN Charter, action with respect to threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression, Article 45, states, in order to enable the UN to take urgent military measures, members shall hold immediately available national Air Force contingents for combined international enforcement action. But the complication is that the P5 member states, US, Great Britain, Russia, China, and France, must come to a collective will for these actions to happen.
Eid is a more somber affair in Gaza this year as Palestinians continue to live under occupation in the specter of genocide. After morning prayers, Muslims often visit the graves of deceased loved ones during the three-day festival that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. A Gazan imam shares why nothing is as usual this time around.
This Eid is completely different from previous Eids in the Gaza Strip. This Eid is full of sacrifices, pain, wounds, the blood of martyrs, the bombing of homes, and the terrorization of safe people. However, we are in the Gaza Strip despite these massacres, these pains, and a large number of martyrs, and most recently last night in the Nusayrat camp. We honor God's rituals on this great and blessed day, and we rejoice and make our children happy on this day.
Just time enough for the final thoughts of Charles Kelly and Mick Napier on a few moments we have left on this show. And before we went to that series there, Charles, we talked about the perhaps perceived toothlessness of the United Nations. At the moment, there's currently a case that's been brought by Nicaragua along the same lines as the South African case, this time against Germany for what Nicaragua is arguing is facilitating the genocide by continuing to sell arms to Israel. Give me your thoughts on that. Will it go anyway differently to the ICJ case with South Africa that's currently being considered?
I think it's helpful in the sense that it brings attention to countries like Germany, and it's educational, but I can't see it going that far. I mean, there was a barrister talking about just things like, you know, it's ironic that Germany is dropping aid by planes into Gaza while at the same time supplying arms that is causing the problem, and it's a terrible situation. The people of Gaza, I saw footage of them celebrating Eid, and you've got to admire their faith to go out and still try and carry on with some sort of normality. But meanwhile, it's a very dark situation for them, and with, you know, Netanyahu promising to go into Rafah. I mean, why this guy is prime minister, I just don't know. His comeback from fraud charges to becoming prime minister again is on a par with the comeback of Lazarus, isn't it? Because what is he, the comeback kid or something? How he can be in power? And now, of course, he needs the war to stay in power. And it's a horrendous situation for the rest of the world, as well as Gaza.
Well, some people are hoping he'll be the Hague kid after this. Mick Napier, the idea here that, as I mentioned in the introduction, Netanyahu says no force in the world will stop this Rafah offensive. It's nonsensical, isn't it?
It's based on his always being able to publicly defy condemnation from the EU, from the UN, but condemnations that rested all at words. And he doesn't care if the whole world recognises that he's a criminal and the whole Zionist elite has long been committed to ethnic cleansing and full-spectrum criminality, as long as there are no effective sanctions. They only respond to force. The problem with the UN is, of course, it's designed in such a way that America and Britain and others can paralyse any action against their interests. I mean, I would like to carry water in a bucket, but if there's a big hole in it, then it's not much use as a bucket. And the UN suffers from a structural weakness of the same kind. We have now got a situation where governments are embarrassed by Israel, but they continue to send bombs together with the criticism. They continue to send bombs and ask for a kinder, gentler genocide. But around the world, Europe is fantastically isolated. We see the Houthis in Yemen coming to the aid of the people of Gaza facing genocide, acting on international law, acting to do everything within their power to end that genocide, and being bombed by Britain and America. But here's the question. Why didn't the US carpet bomb Yemen as they carpet bombed Vietnam with B-52s? They could wipe out everybody. Because they're afraid. They realize that they're in a situation where if they inflame popular opinion throughout the region sufficiently, then they will be defeated. And I think that the resistance across the region, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, everywhere, that's the key to victory. And that backed up by an increasingly angry world public opinion, which can force a political price on our rulers, that's the key to victory. Otherwise, Israel will ultimately generate a huge regional war, which will have cataclysmic suffering for all of us. It was built into the very DNA of the Zionist project to displace millions of local people to make way for European Zionists.
Indeed, and Charles, last thoughts to you here. We're seeing these weekly demonstrations, one coming up in London at the end of this week. Are they working? Are they changing hearts and minds? Less than a minute.
I think gradually they are. And Mick mentioned Zionism, and of course Zionists are not confined to just Jewish people only. The culture of Zionism is embedded into the US culture, the education system, our culture, our Judeo-Christian culture, and Zionism is embedded into that. And you know, it is starting to change the hearts and mind. And Mick also mentioned about the Arab nations, but of course they're not united, are they? And they've got their own interests and their own leagues with the West and their own economic interest. And you could say that some of them just don't care about the Palestinians at all. So there's not a united front against Israel. And indeed, the Arab nations do business with Israel as well. So that, I think that's why Israel can survive. But definitely that Israel is the main cause of instability in that region. And they're bringing us to the brink of world war with their actions, these crazy actions by psychopathic leaders.
Indeed, what a place to leave things on. And that does it for us. Charles Kelly and Mick Napier were our very special guests. And of course, our thanks to them and to you for being with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
July 12, 1983. Place Hosseinia Jamaran, Tehran. The prophets held these two jobs, the spiritual job to extricate the people from captivity of the carnal soul and from the captivity of the clutches of the oppressors. These two tasks are the jobs of the prophets. His Holiness Moses and His Holiness Abraham, His Holiness Christ, in the highest of them all, who is the prophet of God, may Allah's peace be upon him. We see these two tasks manifestly in the Quran and practicing of the tradition of the Messenger of Allah himself. The Quran has invited the people to spirituality to the extent of the ability of mankind can attain, and beyond the next is establishing justice and equality. The Prophet also, as well as those that was the language of the revelation, also followed these two methods. The knowledge of the Prophet himself was such that until the day he had not formed an administration, he would strengthen spirituality. As soon as he was able to establish a rule, he would establish justice in addition to spirituality. He formed a government and rescued the poor from under the yoke of tyrants.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, according to Imam rahmatullah alayhi, the Holy Book of Quran is the man-making book. Islam is the man-making ideology, man in all his dimensions. It is the Holy Book of Quran that guides us to the lofty purposes to which we intuitively turn unaware. The reality of the Holy Quran in the view of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is that as a divine book, it describes the greatest name of the Almighty Allah and considers the perfect man as the face of the greatest name of the Almighty Allah. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh considers the Holy Book of Quran as a miracle, not just due to its cohesion, coherence or rhetoric, but in spite of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam not being literate, it contains evaluated spiritual notions. He recommended us to set the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran in any of its features as our highest purpose. To the extent that acts according to the Holy Book of Quran, we will find coverage under its shield. Quran's banner is not like any other. Quran's banner is conduct per its commands, and there is no school above the Holy Book of Quran. And that was the ideology of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi about this great book. And we shall take lessons from this beautiful ideology and make use of it in our daily lives.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Every night and every day, never forget to say La ilaha illallah.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
The head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, has talked about a staggering rate of child deaths in Gaza, not seen in any conflict in the world. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The French national broadcaster France 24, France 24, has covered this story and tells us more. In an interview with France 24, Catherine Russell, the executive director of the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, sounded the alarm about the plight of children in Gaza after more than 5 months of Israel's brutal war. The head of UNICEF said an estimate of 13,450 children killed in the Palestinian territories since 7th of October last year is probably on the low side. She noted that many more children are trapped in the rubble or are wounded and often separated from their families. Catherine Russell also discussed the incredibly dire situation regarding hunger in Gaza. According to a United Nations-backed food security assessment, half of Gaza's population is experiencing catastrophic hunger, with famine projected to hit northern Gaza any time between now and May without urgent intervention. This is very much a man-made problem, Russell told France 24. All of us in the international community have to do better here and make sure that we can get aid to these children in Gaza. She added, "We cannot have children starving to death in Gaza. That is not acceptable." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The staggering rate of child deaths in Gaza has not been seen in any other conflict in the world, according to UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell, speaking on Sunday, 17th of March. "I think these numbers that we're seeing out of Gaza are just staggering. We haven't seen that rate of death among children in almost any other conflict in the world. It's really shocking," Catherine Russell said during a television program. "More than 13,000 children have been killed, thousands of others injured, trapped under rubble, or have lost their parents," Russell said, adding, "It's a horrifying situation." Catherine Russell added that the profound impact on children in Gaza stemming from the stress, grief, loss, and fear they experience is bound to have lasting effects on them and potentially on their own offspring as well. "We know now that children are dying from malnutrition in Gaza," she said. "I've seen a lot of children, unfortunately, in my job around the world who suffer from malnutrition. It's a shocking thing to see. Essentially, the body starts to consume itself because it has nothing else, and it's a painful, painful death for children." She added that even if therapeutic feeding can be provided to those in need, they often endure lifelong consequences, such as stunted growth, which also affects their cognitive abilities. "It's a lifelong challenge for these children if they survive," she said. Israel has waged a deadly military offensive on Gaza since 7th of October last year. More than 31,600 Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been killed in the enclave, and nearly 73,700 others have been injured, amid mass destruction and shortage of basic necessities. The Israeli war on Gaza has pushed 85% of Gaza's population into internal displacement amid a crippling blockade of food, clean water, and medicine. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story. UNICEF Regional Director for West Asia and North Africa has warned that more children in Gaza will die due to impending famine as the Israeli regime continues to impede aid operations in Gaza. Adel Khodr urged Israel to open all border crossings to allow aid into Gaza Strip, citing the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, recent report warning of an imminent famine in Gaza. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification, or IPC, findings on Gaza confirm what we have been warning about of impending famine for months now. The world's inaction is shocking as more children succumb to a slow death. All border crossings must open now to allow unfettered access to humanitarian aid for the population of Gaza, Adel Khodr wrote on social media post. The IPC, a group that includes the World Food Programme and the World Health Organization, warned that famine is imminent in northern Gaza Strip, with people suffering catastrophic levels of hunger. It said 1.1 million people, half of Gaza's population, are experiencing catastrophic food insecurity. According to the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, virtually all households are skipping meals every day and adults are reducing their meals so that children can eat. In two-thirds of households in northern Gaza, the report said people went entire days and nights without eating at least 10 times in the last 30 days. In southern Gaza Strip, this applies to one-third of the households. In a statement published on Monday, the United States Agency for International Development USAID Administrator Samantha Power said the IPC report is a reality for the population of Gaza. Samantha Power added that there have been only two famine declarations in the 21st century, which marks a truly tragic milestone. The catastrophic levels of hunger and malnutrition described in the IPC report should be unimaginable in the current era. But for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, this is reality, Samantha Power said. Martin Griffiths, the United Nations top relief coordinator, said on X that the international community should hang its head in shame for failing to stop the famine in Gaza. We know that once a famine is declared, it is way too late. The head of UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, Philip Lazzarini, also expressed his disappointment as he was refused entry into Gaza, where he was scheduled to enhance the humanitarian response in the territory. This man-made starvation under our watch is a stain on our collective humanity, Philip Lazzarini wrote on a post on X. Meanwhile, the president of Iran said Ebrahim Raisi has called for a serious practical step to stop the Israeli regime's ongoing attacks on war-torn Gaza. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, was speaking during his New Year message to Asian countries celebrating Nowruz, the Iranian New Year. The Iranian president said Nowruz is a message of peace and peaceful coexistence and also a symbol of reconciliation. The Iranian president said this year, we, the countries of the Nowruz Civilization Zone, are celebrating this auspicious occasion while the oppressed and powerful people of Gaza are facing the brutal attacks of the usurper Zionist regime and are also under a complete siege, being deprived of their access to basic healthcare and basic facilities and are in danger of starvation and famine. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, said, it is our humanitarian duty to use our capabilities to take serious practical steps to stop the attacks of the Zionist regime and send humanitarian aid to the oppressed people of Gaza. The Iranian president sent a message addressed to the leaders and peoples of the countries of the Nowruz Civilization Zone. In a separate New Year message addressed to the Iranian people, President Raisi hailed Gaza's resolute resistance against the brutal Israeli onslaught. He said the global powers use all their might to try to destroy the 2 million people of Gaza. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq has said its fighters have attacked Ben Gurion Airport twice in the past week using drones. In a statement on Wednesday, 20th of March, the Iraqi resistance confirmed its attack on the Israeli regime, which is currently waging a genocidal war on the people of Gaza. The fighters of the Islamic Resistance in Iraq at dawn on Tuesday have targeted Ben Gurion Airport in the Zionist regime using drones. The resistance also affirmed its commitment to strike the enemy's stronghold as part of its second phase of operations in support of the Palestinians of Gaza. In response to the Israeli massacre of Palestinian civilians, the second phase of the resistance's operations has started, which include the enforcement of a blockade on Israeli maritime navigation in the Mediterranean Sea and putting Israeli ports out of service. The resistance also attacked the same airport on 12th of March using drones. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it will continue its attacks on Israeli targets until Israel stops its genocidal war in Gaza.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So we have a question that we had been discussing in the past sessions, and it was about a 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother. And the mother was concerned about how she should, you know, go about it. And you had given us very good tips, one of which was, you know, we have to try and be positive, we have to do active listening. Do you have anything more to say?
Yes, we talked about the fact that when a parent wants to talk to her teenage, a mother wants to talk to her teenage, she should capture a moment when the teenage feels like talking. Sometimes it so happens then that the mother wants to, or the father wants to talk to them, but they're not in a mood of talking. So we should respect those moments of them, their privacies. True. Maybe they're so bottled up inside that they don't feel like, you know, relating and showing their weaknesses. Or maybe they feel like, you know, just talking to themselves, you can say, or just sleeping over it and forgetting a little about the pain. But then it happens so that they forget and they are easy a bit when time passes. And then when they so happen to want to talk about it, you know, because if they see that there is so much compassion at home, then they know that their parents relate to them, especially the mother. So she will, a teenage girl especially, would feel like talking, and she would then, you know, like ask the parent to listen to them. And therefore, this mother who wants to talk to her, whatever she be doing at that time, she should leave. Of course, apart from the other things that are so wajib, like prayer and everything. But of course, at that time, she should, you know, like capture that moment and...
I think it also helps remove the barrier, because sometimes those barriers are built between the parents and children, because the teenagers feel like the parents just don't understand them.
Yes.
They don't respect their, you know, boundaries and etc. So,
and why do they think that their friends do? It's because their friends do active listening.
Mm.
They're so like, you know, eager, and they're so willing to listen.
True.
And they, you know, they share those sorrows with them also. So they know that there's a listening ear, and the best is the parent if she gives that listening ear. And mostly parents do that, but sometimes it happens so that the parents forget about this thing. They don't capture themselves as being young, you know, one day. One day all of us, the parents were also young, and... they don't know how it feels to be in the skin of a young person.
Very true.
You know, they forget about it.
Well, and I think sometimes parents resort to giving solutions straight away, or they judge them, or the teenagers feel judged. And usually from their friends,
absolutely,
they feel like, okay, now they understand.
Yes, they don't judge them, exactly. So this is even part of active listening.
Yeah.
And then we talked about being positive. Always look at the bright side of things.
Yeah.
You know, like... if we are so much negative ourselves, then the child will take that negative energy and feel more sorrowful over what matter they are, maybe, you know, like feeling sad over.
True.
So, however much at home we are supposed to be positive, to bring that positive nature about it, like, what a good day I had today, such and such good thing happened. Maybe, for example, we did a good thing in the morning, and then we enjoyed our breakfast. When we went, we saw this, and we admired the beauty of the nature, or whatever be it, you know, some things that need to be mostly pumped in, like to the youth, that to bring about that positive nature at home.
True.
It's very important.
I think the vibe is very important.
Yes, the vibe.
So we'll just take a quick break and pick up shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio, and we have been discussing about one of the questions that had been previously asked about a mother worried about her 15-year-old daughter who doesn't talk about her problems to her mother anymore. And you gave some very informative lessons in how to deal with the teenagers. So did you want to expand on those?
Yes. Another way to open up a conversation with her teenage daughter is maybe focus on their interests. This is very important that, you know, when a person is interested in something and probably you are not, you shouldn't, you know, forego that as something that, or take it for granted.
Yeah.
For example, if your daughter is interested in crafts work or maybe some creativity or artwork or cooking or, you know, anything, reading. So know that subject as, you know, take it seriously. I guess when a parent is really caring, it happens.
Yeah.
That when a parent is caring, they see even the boy's interest or the girl's interest, and they search on that, and they want to see more on that, maybe documentaries or read about it, and then talk to them about it. Yeah. So they know that this, my parent is sharing my interests with me.
True.
So they have more to talk about. So what happens is that when they see that the small stuff is not taken for granted, you know, like small hobbies or things that they like, or remembering their favorite color, remembering their favorite dish and things like that, or what they like and discussing about it and giving a comment on that, they know that the parents share their interests about the small stuff, so they will also resort to in the big matters.
Very like, true. You know? I think many teenagers go through this, that you know, nobody understands me and nobody really cares for me, and however much you go and tell them, no, we care, no,
yeah,
they have to see
that's
through
not
action.
Enough, yeah.
So when parents actually show interest in what they're doing, not just for the sake of it, no actual interest. And teenagers are very smart, yeah, they know when the parents are just saying feeling or doing something for the sake of that.
It's so nice that if a daughter is so much taken up with the interests of the parent, like sometimes, you know, in creativity, a mother likes to stitch, so the child even feels that, you know, urge to want to explore that field and stitch and everything. So both can discuss so well on that matter, or cooking or anything, reading, for instance, or, matters that are political matters of the day-to-day time, and they can discuss on that too, or a subject for that matter, for example English literature or literary subject like Nahjul Balagha, the eloquence of it, and parents or Quran, for instance. Parents can discuss so much with the children, that really gives a big heart to the parents especially. But however, we say that if the child has different interests, probe on those interests and see what the goodness comes out of it. And maybe here and there you can comment on that, and you can ask them, have you discovered this part of your interest, and this interest of yours has these kind of advantages, or what did you do about it, maybe have you done anything new, for example art is concerned. It's a very good talent, but of course it has to be taken seriously and discussed about and shown interest.
Very true, very true. So let's just have a short break and we will continue shortly.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat.
Welcome back, and we have been discussing about what to do to have a better relation with your teenage children especially. And Sister Salma has been telling us a lot about how to deal with that, focus on their interests, show interest in their interests, and that will really build a bond. So do you want to say more on that?
Yes, another thing that I want to point out is avoid talking too much. Although we just discussed about how there should be a verbal interaction between the parent and the child, the teenager, that you have to know about their interests and everything, but here avoid talking too much in the other times.
Yeah.
For example, however much you speak to an adult who's your age or something, try to hear out more from your teenager.
True.
In fact, even from your children, they have so much to let out, their energy and everything, and then you should lend the listening ear, and especially teenagers don't like you to advise them and to give a lecture, or talking too much in the sense of giving them a lecture, or even telling them about your own things. They like to be listened to. And in fact, this is a universal thing, if you go and see, mostly people, when they're listened to actively, they really appreciate that more than when you give your opinions.
True.
Even a friend, even somebody who is a soulmate, your best friend,
husband.
They listen to you, you would appreciate them more. So avoid talking too much and excessively also, and also questioning them. That why did you do this? Why don't you do this? Why did you, you made your own mistakes, so judging them.
Yeah.
They would repel from that, and they would feel that, just to turn a deaf ear on whatever we are saying.
True.
And they would not confide then. So to want to make a teenager talk to you is that try to talk less and listen more.
Yeah. Showing that interest, showing that I'm here for you, and giving that full attention,
and also that you are supposed to talk more than me, and then another thing is that admitting our mistakes. Sometimes when we make mistakes, we don't admit them, they pile up. When they pile up, the teenager feels that my mother is always in cross with me, and she's always at loggerheads with me, so I can't relate to her. But if you admit your mistakes, then they know even how to admit their mistakes.
True.
They know that it's nothing wrong to do that, and that's why we have rights of a child also, rights of a, and especially when it comes to adult child, like for example a teenager is now has the right mind to decide between right and wrong. So he sees or she sees what's going on and they don't like some things. So we shouldn't say that it's a child, he's my child, I have authority over them. Yeah. You know, although you have guidance and you share more authority, but you have no right to, for example, tease them or, you know, pass a comment that makes them feel hurt. So you should, like, even if you, for example, sometimes, you know, parents tend to joke about maybe the clothing style or the hairstyle. So the girl especially takes it very much at heart.
Yeah.
So this needs to be corrected before it's too late. So the parent should be sensitive enough to see what makes them feel bad, what makes them, you know, like comments that we talk to our friends about our girls when they are nearby.
Yeah.
So that we should be very careful and hypersensitive about it, that what makes our children feel bad, we should not, stake that with the relationship.
Yeah, I agree. I remember even when I was a child, if even though there was something very simple, very small, you know, it wasn't even very important, but as soon as my parents would, you know, joke about it, I would take it very much to heart. Like, I'd feel like they're disrespecting me when they had no intention whatsoever. And after that, I think because my mother made a bond with me, I was able to communicate that. And then she realized, okay, no, then we shouldn't bring these matters about. And alhamdulillah, that really, you know, put my self-esteem up, because otherwise it's very easy to get a low self-esteem from that young age if the parents, you know, joke about them or tease their children too much with a good heart, but it has its, you know, its stakes.
Yes,
as you said.
So last but not least, we should also consider one point, and that's very important for all ages, not only teenagers, in fact for adults as well, is that you should remind them that you love them. And not just, you know, oh, just remember that I love you. No, it's concentrating on that, pointing out the qualities, what you like, what you appreciate, and also acknowledge the fact that, you know, you receive that love from them. So it's not just one-sided, it should be two-sided. Acknowledge it, yeah?
Yeah.
That remind them that how important they are in your lives. Remind them all these things so that they can feel that, empowered. Because love is the only thing that really empowers a person.
True.
Yeah, they'll feel so much trust and satisfaction, and of course they'll have a better relationship with the parents as life goes on. Mostly, if you go and see when teenagers grow up to be adults, they say they were not close with their parents. And it's really a sad thing, to hear that a girl is not close to her parent. Why? It's because there was this communication gap between them. But the parent has to remind that, remember, you are very important for me. You know, we think that it's just small children who need to be cuddled and loved and hugged, but it's also elder children.
Definitely.
They need to have that even probably more, because they shouldn't look for it outside. You know, they know that they have a very strong relationship with their, at least one of their parents. They know that they can confide. They know that they can even embrace them and hug them and, you know, feel relaxed with them. So the parents should never refrain from that.
Very true, very true. So that was very, very insightful. And thank you very much for your valuable time, Sister Salma. And we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI. Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.